right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says North Korea's decision to suspend nuclear and long-range missile tests and close its nuclear test site is a tribute to what the UN Security Council can accomplish.
When the Security Council is united and adopts together important measures, they have an impact on the ground and they make things change. And today, I believe in North Korea, the path is open for the peaceful denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
North Korea made the announcement saying it will never use nuclear weapons nor transfer nuclear weapons or nuclear technology under any circumstances unless there are nuclear threats and provocation against the DPRK. Following the announcement, U.S. President Donald Trump tweeted the announcement as a very good news for North Korea and the world and said he's looking forward to a summit. Acting Secretary of State John Sullivan says North Korea is an egregious human rights abuser, but says it's not alone.
China continues to spread the worst features of its authoritarian system, including restrictions on activists, civil society, freedom of expression, and the use of arbitrary surveillance.
The State Department report lists four nations, Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea, and also condemns the violence against Burma's Rohingya minority. The Israeli military has killed four Palestinians, including a 15-year-old boy, according to Gaza health authorities. Officials say more than 150 people were wounded Friday in the protests at the Gaza-Israeli border. More than 30 people have been killed since the protests started 4 weeks ago. Media accounts say several thousand protesters came near the Gaza-Israeli border demonstration Friday, but most of them gathered in tent camps along the border. This is VOA News. The United Special Envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura, says that the war-ravaged country has had a very dangerous week.
There was a lot of moments when we were extremely concerned. But I think that we have seen that the Russian and the U.S. military to military, the conflicting mechanism has been working.
Meanwhile, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov claims that the United States inquired about Moscow's positions in Syria prior to last week's U.S. and allied airstrikes and avoided those areas. He adds that despite rising tensions between Moscow and Washington, the U.S. ensured that Russian personnel and positions were not targeted during attacks against the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad after suspected chemical attacks on the town of Douma. The Indian cabinet has approved the death penalty for convicted rapist of children under the age of 12. This is to help stem a worrying rise in violent crime against young girls and women. The emergency executive order was announced Saturday following a meeting called by the Prime Minister in the wake of nationwide outrage over the brutal gang rape and murder of an 8-year-old girl and other rape cases of minor girls. The UN Refugee Agency has announced and denounced the latest forcible deportations of Nigerian refugees to violence-prone Borno State by Cameroon, calling it a violation of international law. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says it is alarmed at what appears to be an unsettling pattern of forced returns. So far this year, the UNHCR reports Cameroon has forcibly deported 385 Nigerians to Borno State, the majority of them this month. Most recently, the agency reports 118 Nigerian asylum seekers were forcibly returned on April 17th. Just a week earlier, on April 10th, 160 Nigerian refugees and asylum seekers were deported.
Several former U.S. presidents are among the hundreds of mourners paying tribute in their respects this Saturday to former First Lady Barbara Bush, who died Tuesday at the age of 92. She was the wife of the 41st U.S. President George H.W. Bush and the mother of George W. Bush, the country's 43rd president. In addition to her husband and oldest son, Barack Obama and Bill Clinton are among the former presidents to attend Bush's funeral at St. Martin's Episcopal Church in the southern city of Houston, Texas. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
I was in a meeting with generals when I am no longer a president, so nobody will expect the former president to say, yes, I was in a meeting.
Former Sierra Leonean President Ernest Bai Koroma denies secretly meeting military officers.
The people are starting to see who's going to be part of the prime minister's cabinet, because just analyzing the prime minister without the government, I think it's a puzzle missing pieces.
And Guinea-Bissau's parliament meets for the first time in nearly 2 years. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The International Monetary Fund experts say the global economy will continue growing well for the next 2 years, but expect expansion to slow after 2020. The announcement was made at the 2018 spring meetings of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank Group in Washington. Alexander Chiteme is the Zambian Minister for National Development Planning. He attended the annual World Bank IMF spring meeting here in Washington and joins me live here in the studio. Hello, Mr. Chairman. How are you?
Hello, Peter. I'm fine. How are you?
Good.
How are you to all the listeners across the globe?
Wonderful. So tell me, what were some of the takeaways of the meeting you attended here in Washington?
Well, we had some very fruitful meetings with both the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And we are very hopeful of the outcome of the meetings because as a country, we are open to discuss frankly with both the Fund and the World Bank on the takeaways that we can take back home and say we attended the meeting and these are the fundamentals that we've come back with, both in regard to the projects that we are doing with the World Bank and in terms of getting to the program with the IMF.
What are your expectations? What do you expect to achieve? What do you expect to take back to the people in Lusaka?
Well, we are very optimistic, especially with what we are taking back in terms of projects that we are doing with the World Bank. I mean, we've been talking about our absorption rate for the projects that we're doing with the World Bank. You see, we are lagging between 18 and 8% between our absorption rates in World Bank-funded projects in relation to the IDA programs as well. So we're thinking that, can we at least up our absorption rates to 50, 100%, that we can actually begin to actualize benefits for people in Africa, in Zambia, so that we can get the benefits to the people. And with the World Bank, we're beginning to begin a process where we are seeing ourselves in a transparent manner. You see, there's been a lot of speculation in the market and with you news personnel on how our date is and everything else. And we're beginning to speak very frankly, very openly with the IMF so that we can begin a process that is going to be very open and transparent so that we can take away a program to Zambia.
Now, Mr. Chiteme, I understand Zambia recently outlined what it called the 7th National Development Plan. What does this plan entail and what measures do you seek to implement to ensure its success?
7th National Development Plan.
Right.
You see, I mean, just at the mention of the plan, and it gives a smile to my, to me, I mean, it's a very good plan. I was talking to one of our executive directors at the National Construction Commission. Right now, they're in the Gambia, you know, at a quantity surveyors conference. And, you know, they were telling them to say that the Gambia has developed their plan as a carbon copy of our 7th National Development Plan. You see, that gives me pride, and it tells me to say that Zambia has developed a plan that is a wonder and that is a good plan to the world. But a plan is nothing until it is implemented.
Right.
That's us taking our second step now, doing the volume 2 of our plan, which is the implementation of the 7th National Development Plan.
Give me examples of the plan that you intend to implement and what specific measures you intend to implement to ensure its actualization.
You know, we have gone a mile in trying to make sure that we have implemented this plan. First of all, we as a government have ensured that we mobilize resources to make sure that we implement this very wonderful plan. It's a plan that has been approved in all quarters. It was developed with the help of the World Bank, and the World Bank is buying into the plan. So when we're saying that we have got a plan, but the basic and the most important thing is that we implement the plan.
What is the plan? Are you building hospitals? Are you building roads? What entails in the plan?
I would want to invite you to look into the actual plan. It's actually a voluminous document. It's a document that has to be read in its totality and understood. And in this vein, we want to invite people, the investors here, the pension funds in America, the pension funds in Europe, everywhere else, to get to read through our plan so that they can see our development agenda. Because what we are looking for as a government is to sell what is in our 7th National Development Plan. As I'm leaving this studio today, I want to hand you a copy of that plan.
All right.
So that you can actually sell our plan as well. Because it's a very robust plan. It's a plan that is going to sell our country. And it's a plan that you can tap in, because the government of the Republic of Zambia has insisted that to finance this plan, we have to involve not only domestic resource mobilization, mm-hmm. but also the private sector, also the bond markets across the world, so that we can do private partnerships, we can do joint ventures to actualize the gap in the financing of the plan.
So do you have specific targets by which you want this plan to be actualized? Because a lot of governments come up with lofty plans, exceptional plans. Implementation sometimes is woefully inadequate. What is different from yours?
What is different from us is that as a government, we have separated the Ministry of Finance from the Ministry of National Planning. Now we've got a dedicated Ministry of National Development Planning, which is my ministry.
Right.
A ministry that is going to look into the plan and its implementation. So we are a dedicated ministry that is going to, day and night, look at how we are going to achieve the plan, looking at where we are going to finance the gap of the plan, looking at how we are going to actually integrate our resources and the resources of our cooperating partners into the plan.
Well, talking about financing, you're talking about garnering resources. Will the government be borrowing? Because critics of your government say that borrowing of the government is overwhelming and could crush Zambia's economy. They're talking about 60% of the budget is being borrowed. Your take?
Peter, there's no country that has developed without borrowing. Okay, and the critical part of borrowing is how you utilize the money that you have borrowed. America has not developed from its own resources. America borrowed, even from China. Europe borrowed. Every other country has borrowed to champion their development goals. And from the borrowing now, they have learned how to make sure that the money that they have borrowed circulates within their country. That's what makes America great. Because now they no longer borrow, because after borrowing, they utilized it.
What is the specific cost of the plan?
Zambia is a developing country.
Right.
And borrowing is at the core of our development. Mm. And to develop, we are going to borrow. And what we should be watched is how we are using the money that we have borrowed.
Well, that is a concern to many people, because a lot of African governments borrow. The money earmarked for some of these projects gets embezzled, sometimes with people committing all kinds of financial malfeasances. What specific measures do you have in the government to prevent some of these from happening?
Happily for Zambia, we have embarked on a robust legal framework that is going to be addressed in our parliament, that is going to be addressed in our cabinet, where we are revising the laws to strengthen those embezzlements. We have recently approved the Financial Services Bill that has gone through into parliament, which is becoming a law in Zambia. We are, we're implementing the budgeting and planning bill. We are doing the procurement bill. We are doing the loans and guarantees bill. We are doing all these sorts of bills that are going to seal all those gaps where all these embezzlement of funds were possible maybe before, but not in this regime. We are trying to close the gaps so that whatever money we get for development actually goes and is targeted for development.
So let me ask you this. If an ordinary or a typical Zambian comes to you, Mr. Chitemi, and says, the government has been harping on this development plan as the most significant, as the most well thought out with all kinds of things, how will this be beneficial to the ordinary Zambian?
Beneficiation is relative. We have programs that we think that are for the future, and we have got programs that we think that are for the immediate benefit of the Zambian people.
What is for the immediate?
For the immediate, we've got like the Juo project that is being funded by the World Bank. Okay, it's a project that is taking girl children to school, that is offering scholarships to school, to school-going children. That is an initial benefit, some benefits like social cash transfer that is being supported also by corporate partners. So you see those are immediate benefits that are going to go to the people. But we have projects like damming. You know, Zambia is one of the countries in the southern part of Africa. We are a landlocked country, but we've got water bodies, but we don't have the reservoirs to keep our water. So we are saying, okay, please come in and build dams. Those dams are not going to be of the direct benefit for the people today until those dams are done, built, and filled. And the ancillary benefits come as in irrigation, smallholder farmers, and everything else. So we are talking about not today, but tomorrow and the future. So we've got projects that can benefit people right now, and we've got projects that are going to benefit the people 3, 5, 10 years in the future.
Before we go, Mr. Chitemi, what do you want to see in your ministry before the end of the year that an ordinary Zambian would say, okay, this development and planning minister did something significant to improve my life before the year ends?
Peter, I'll tell you, I'm a new minister in this ministry.
Right.
And I want to see that whatever we bring into the country has got the benefit for the people.
Right.
It's about the time that we Africans begin to think about our people, not about our selfish intentions as leaders in countries. We need to think, what are we going to do that is going to benefit our hungry people, that is going to benefit the people that are out there with the water and sanitation, that is going to benefit the people out there that don't have access to good roads, that don't have access to implements in terms of agriculture implements. Because when we're talking about Africa, we're talking about agriculture. That's a major industry that we have in Africa. So we need to look at solutions, interventions that are going to benefit the family unit, the individual families at the household level. So we are looking at a platform where we are going to see that the benefit of all the instruments that we are getting from the World Bank, that we are getting from the African Development Bank, that we are getting from all the cooperating partners, is going to be a seed that is going to sit in the household.
So let me ask you this before we go again. What do you see the government achieving by the end of this year? Because some of opposition figures that I have spoken with a couple of times are saying the president is becoming dictatorial, but we'll continue when we come back. Alexander Chitemi is the Zambia Minister for National Development Planning. He joined me live here in Washington, D.C. Former Sierra Leonean President Ernest Bai Koroma has rejected accusations that he was in a recent clandestine meeting with military officers at one of his residences in Makene City in the country's north. It came after Lahai Lawrence Lima, spokesman for the ruling Sierra Leone People's Party, or SLPP, made the allegation on his Facebook page, which went viral on all social media platforms. In a statement, the office of the former president says the accusation is baseless and a danger to the country's peace and security. It demands that the ruling party immediately retract the accusation. For reaction, I reach Mr. Lima, spokesman for the SLPP in the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown.
I didn't know what the plan was. I was not in Freetown and I could not tell what the game was up to. And I wouldn't want to keep it to myself until things go bad, and then that will not be good for us. So I thought one could be proactive by bringing it public and raise public awareness to it so that you can narrow the space or disrupt whatever formation people are up to create issues. And so I have to bring it public by saying that my attention has been drawn to certain secret meetings And that if that is anything to go by, it's one thing that is not good, and they should drop it and realize that there has been a change of regime.
The former president's office released a statement and said that the president has not left Freetown to Makene City since President Madabio was sworn in. And so this allegation basically is false. How do you react to that?
Well, the thing is, the meeting is a secret meeting. And if it is a secret meeting, the former president is a public figure. And you will not expect him really to say, yes, I was in a meeting with generals when I am no longer a president. So nobody will expect the former president to say, yes, I was in a secret meeting. But what is clear is the fact that a clandestine activity was going on in Makene, to which insiders we are not comfortable with, and they have to draw my attention to it. They have to draw my attention to it by saying that there is a meeting going on at the president's lodge, and it's good for us to really pay attention to that.
Lahai, they are saying that these are unfounded allegations, and it brings to mind memories of how innocent Sierra Leoneans were in the past implicated on trumped-up allegations of treason, resulting in unimaginable extrajudicial consequences for them and their families. And this is an example of such act. This is a very serious allegation, don't you think so?
Let me bring you back to instances, much as they have also gone to draw instances. President Kaba, before his exile, President Kaba had the information of a coup plan of which he trivialized, and they decided to leave behind the scene. When he spoke to the then chief of defense staff, he told him everything was under control, and he relied on that, only for him to realize himself in exile before he realized that what he was informed of has an element of truth. And so, learning from that experience, and given the fact that a very large deposit of arms and ammunition we are received for the electoral process, and those arms and ammunition have not been retrieved yet, and at the same time, people who have been placed in critical and sensitive positions continue to man those positions, and of which people still continue to pay loyalty even when there has been change of systems, you really do not want to downplay any situation of that nature that borders on security and that borders on the existence and survivors of people. You really do not want to play with it. And at the same time, you don't want to bring it as a factual statement, but at the same time, it's of a serious concern that you really have to disable whatever is going on.
The former president's office is demanding an immediate retraction by the SLPP of such unfounded allegation by their national official spokesman. Will you retract this statement?
I will not retract that statement. And let me also recall the former president's attention to video tape he did immediately after he had a meeting with His Excellency the President, retired Brigadier Julius Madabio. They had a meeting, and of which the president assured him of his support anytime he needs his support. And in about 2 days' time, we saw a video on the social media where the former president was making unfounded allegations against the president that he has actually done a press release to arrest all of his former ministers, and of which the president was never, ever in any circumstances has ever ordered any arrest warrants or any instances of going after former ministers. So if the president had had a public show of that nature, right, showcasing what has not actually come in, even into the minds of His Excellency the President General Bio, then it's a clear indication that the president would certainly not want to take course of a very sensitive information that was also left to us as a party and as a government. I want to also accept that because he is very much in the known that such a meeting is actually not one one has to actually conduct. Well, one would also want to say perhaps they have done it in advance of the fact that they are no longer in charge. And now that it has also come to our attention, and it's something if they should try to actually manage or control the damage. If the military chain of command has still not come to the realization that there has been a change of regime, and loyalty, 100% loyalty, should shift.
Lahai Lawrence Lima is the spokesman for the Sierra Leonean People's Party, or SLPP. He spoke with me from Freetown. This week, the Guinea-Bissau Parliament met for the first time in nearly 2 years. The parliamentary meeting came after President José Mário Vaz announced the appointment of what he called a consensus prime minister to end the country's political crisis. The appointment followed a meeting of regional leaders from the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. The leaders asked the Guinea-Bissau president to honor a 2016 accord. Meanwhile, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has urged the administration to quickly form an inclusive government. For analysis, I reach Elizabeth Marian Gomez-Sarr, a communication expert in the Guinea-Bissau capital, Bissau.
People are skeptical because we've been seeing the president pointing, this is his seventh prime minister. So to say that this prime minister is going to manage the country and help the country go to elections, basically we're having a transition prime minister, because the parliamentarian work is going to finish on the 23rd, that's next Monday. So we're about to have a transition period with a transition government. And if this prime minister does something that does not apprise the president, he might go again and we may have an eighth prime minister, you see. We saw the parliament opening, and with that they appointed the department that's going to manage the elections.
The president had a problem with his own ruling party. Does he have any support from the opposition following the announcement of this consensus candidate as a prime minister?
I think he had a problem with his party, but he also had a problem with the opposition since they denied it to be part of the former prime minister government. So once they reach a consensus, I believe that the two parties are going to try to work together to have a consensus government. The president, he's not the head of the government. He doesn't hold the executive power. It shouldn't be an issue. He can't have an issue with his party or the opposition, but they could continue working. But when you have the two major parties, PSC and PRS, working together and finally finding a consensus name for a prime minister, because who they appoint to be the Minister of Territorial Affairs, he's a minister who's going to manage the election. So we have to see who are they going to appoint. Is it someone from PSC? Is it from someone from PRS? Is it someone independent? Because that will count at the end if they'll decide to call this election fair or not.
Have these opposition parties dropped their demands for the president to resign, for which they are now seeking to work with the president for a unity government?
I think that they came to a conclusion that the president won't resign, and the parliament, they do have power, but they don't have enough votes to make the president resign. So what they have to do is what is practical, is to have elections this year and then presidential elections next year.
Do you think the intervention of ECOWAS has helped in moving and trying to resolve this political crisis in Guinea-Bissau?
Somehow it did. It did, specifically when they decided to go ahead and sanction some people. Because they've been talking about sanctions for the past year. Basically, they never really worked upon it. And since the moment they did, that obliged PSC and PRS to work together to have a consensus prime minister. Because after the collapse, we waited 2 years to have this happening. And it only happened now after ECOWAS sanction. And for the fact that ECOWAS has a peacekeeping mission here, that also helped not to have the military involved in political issues, which happened in the past. Because basically since 94, we always had issues with political crises and coups and military involved. Right now, because ECOWAS has a peacekeeping mission here, that didn't happen.
So what are the expectations of the people of Guinea-Bissau following the announcement?
I think people are really doing that. They're expecting, who is he going to call as the Minister of Finance? Who is he going to call as the Minister of Education? The people are starting to see who's going to be part of the Prime Minister's cabinet, because just analyzing the Prime Minister without the government, I think it's a puzzle missing pieces. We need to see who will be the members of the government. Then we'll know what to expect.
Elizabeth Marian Gomez-Sarr is a communication expert in Guinea-Bissau. She spoke with me from Bissau. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotin, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the UN Refugee Agency denounces the latest forcible deportations of Nigerian refugees to violence-prone Borno State by Cameroon, calling it a violation of international law. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says it is alarmed at what appears to be an unsettling pattern of forced returns. So far this year, the UNHCR reports Cameroon has forcibly deported 385 Nigerians to Borno State, the majority of them this month. Most recently, the agency reports 118 Nigerian asylum seekers were forcibly returned on April 17th. Just a week earlier, on April 10th, 160 Nigerian refugees and asylum seekers were deported. UNHCR regional spokesman for West Africa, Romain Desclous, says the April 17th group had arrived in Cameroon only 2 days earlier, having fled violence by the militant Boko Haram. On a line from Dakar, Senegal, he tells VOA, "It is shocking for people to be returned to face the same risks from which they have fled."
We are concerned it has happened this month twice already. We were concerned and alarmed that it had happened several times in the past 12 months. So we have shared our concern with our government and the authorities that this is something that is in contravention with international and even national obligations. And we're working with the Cameroon authorities to make sure this doesn't happen again.
Desclous says refugee returns should be voluntary and should only take place when conditions are conducive for their safe return. He says this is not the case in Borno State, which is still wracked by violence. He commends Cameroon for its generosity in hosting 87,600 Nigerian refugees, as well as another 240,000 refugees from Central African Republic. He recognizes Cameroon has legitimate security concerns stemming from the Boko Haram crisis, but he notes this does not exempt the government from its obligation to protect people fleeing insecurity and persecution. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Zimbabwean Parliament wants former President Robert Mugabe to appear before a committee on May 9. The lawmakers seek to question the former leader regarding his 2016 statement that the country lost $15 billion due to corruption and foreign exploitation in the diamond sector. The Parliamentary Committee on Mines and Energy says there's need for Mugabe to explain the disappearance of the $15 billion worth of diamonds. The move has drawn mixed reaction, with some saying the 94-year-old should be left alone. For more about the parliamentary summon, I reach Rejoice Ngwenya, a Zimbabwean political analyst in the capital, Harare.
I want to commend the committee for being ambitious, but this ambition is really bravado. Why? Because they have already failed to interview Obed Mpofu, who was a key member of the team of the ministry during the time when mostly of these diamonds were spirited out of the country. So I'm not so sure what kind of evidence they would require from Mugabe, because I don't think Mugabe was in the epicenter of this corruption. And besides, a 94-year-old man is going to be talking about the coup. I don't think he's going to be worried anymore about any credible evidence. He will just be talking about things that are grieving him. I don't think it's a good idea.
Do you think that this will offer him a platform to air his grievances about what he has consistently said was a coup d'etat or the overthrow of his government by the military?
Absolutely. I'm saying to myself, if I was Mugabe and I've suddenly been given space to actually explain things that aggrieve me, I'll go straight into the issues that relate to the snatching of the power through the military. I don't think the issue of diamonds is uppermost in his mind. He will just exploit the opportunity, limelight, to pour out his heart on what really aggrieves him most, which is the military takeover of the government.
So do you think this is an offer he can't refuse? Do you even see him being there at all, answering to the call?
So I don't think his handlers, when I'm talking about his handlers, I'm talking about his cousins, I don't think that they will allow him to expose himself, because look, he's an old man, and we might be thinking that he will be talking about what aggrieves him, but they might not necessarily want to expose him, because they can't be sure how he's going to respond, because I'm sure he has a certain control of his faculties. So it might be one hell of a risk to expose him to the cameras.
Some Zimbabweans are saying that it was right for the lawmakers to invite Mr. Mugabe to come and testify, because the lawmakers plan to question him over his 2016 claim that a country had lost nearly $15 billion due to corruption and foreign exploitation in the diamond sector, and that this money belongs to the people, so they need to find out what happened. What do you make of it?
Absolutely. It might be correct, but it's not necessarily rational. Because, look, there's been consistent and persistent evidence that Zimbabwe never had $15 billion worth of diamonds in the first place. So the diamond specialists themselves, political analysts, are really arguing there is no consensus about the value of the diamond. And besides, where did he get the figure from? I mean, if this figure had come from the international diamond sector, one would actually assign some kind of credibility. But I think this figure really is fictitious, and I think it would be a waste of time to bring an old man to testify against the figure that he just plucked out of the sky.
So you think this is just a mere publicity exercise for the parliamentarians, as well as an opportunity for former President Mugabe? And how are people reacting to this, by the way?
People are really, like, they are skeptical, because they don't really think that Mugabe is going to take up the offer. But I personally think that it might just be a public relations stunt on the part of the parliamentary committee to just prove that they've pulled the big tiger out of the woods. But otherwise, really, I personally feel that Zimbabweans are right to be skeptical, because this is a total waste of time, and I don't think it's going to happen.
Rejoice Ngwenya is a Zimbabwean political analyst. He spoke with me from Harare. Africa may be facing a silent refugee crisis, according to a recent report by the International Displacement Monitoring Center. The number of internally displaced people across Africa is more than twice as many as the continent's total refugee population of 5.4 million, which only accounts for those who have crossed national borders. Sub-Saharan Africa hosts more than 26% of the world's refugee population. For more on the refugee crisis in Africa, my colleague Douglas Impuga reached Mohamed Ademo, the co-founder and editor at opride.com in Washington.
I think it's a big crisis. It's a big problem for the African continent. On the one hand, Africa has a young population that needs jobs, that needs opportunities, but also needs freedom. But there are also leaders, on the other hand, who continue to hold on to the old practices of repression, and in conflict is still a problem. Burundi, South Sudan, some of the contributors for the crisis, but also long-ranging problems like Eritrea, Somalia, problem in Somalia refuses to go away. So you put all those together, I think conflict, yes, but also countries like Ethiopia, Sudan, in others that are a bit more stable but still are not free, where young people especially feel that they have a future, they have a place in the society. So they're voting with their legs, because they can vote at the ballot box and have a hopeful future at home. So it's a big crisis for the continent as a whole, and the African Union needs to really take this issue as one of it is perennial questions that need to be addressed, and that has not been done so far.
Some people have observed that the problem actually is that the leadership in most African countries have not taken care of the root cause of this problem, which is war, internal conflicts, drought, poor economies. Do you see a will among the leadership on the continent to address these issues?
No, you can't separate conflict from failure of leadership. And I don't think the only solution to deal with conflict and tensions is by war or by insisting on staying on power beyond what some of the constitution demands or by making changes to constitutions of the countries. So I think the core issue here is the failure of African leadership. We failed to harness not only our natural resources but also our human capital. Why should the Chinese be moving to Africa when Africans are running away from the continent? Then today there are more than 2 million Chinese who have come to the continent of Africa looking for opportunities, looking for investment, looking for jobs. Some of them come with Chinese companies who invest in Africa, but they come because those opportunities are there. So the African leaders have not found a way to let go of power. This hunger for power continues to be an African problem, but I think there is nowhere else that is more evident than Eritrea that has not had an election for more than 25 years now. And I think it's a failure of leadership at the country level, also a failure of leadership at the continental level. So it's a collective failure of leadership. While that is happening, of course, the people who are refugees and are paying a huge price. It's not easy to leave your country, leave everything behind, and try to find your food elsewhere. So it's a conflict is a symptom, but the larger problem, I think, is the failure of leadership.
So how does one solve that issue?
It's certainly a complicated issue, but I think from the young people perspective, from the African perspective, I think we also need a change of a mindset that there are problems. And it's a bit hypocritical for me to say this, but I think as an exiled journalist myself, but I think the idea that I think is better to stay and fight these leaders and bring about change, that idea needs to resonate with more and more people. And I think that message doesn't usually get across very well because we are focused on the leaders and sometimes we neglect the power we have as citizens of these countries to demand change. And if the change doesn't come, enforce the hands of our leaders, and I know it is a tall order. There is no equivalence here. The state is heavily armed, and you are protesting on the street. But we have seen the power of that in the Gambia, in Burkina Faso, even in Zimbabwe. There is an element of organizing, relentless organizing, that went on for a year. But you know, eventually the military stepped in. You saw that in Egypt. You are seeing something of that nature in Ethiopia, another very repressive state where 3 years of protests have really forced the authorities to give in, and we'll see how far-reaching the change will be. But I think, nonetheless, that's the result of young people deciding to fight for their future. So that needs to change. And as far as the African leaders, and I think some of the problems may only be unfortunately solved once these leaders die and leave office.
Mohamed Ademo is the co-founder and editor at opride.com. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from here in Washington. It's now time for music from our African collection. I wish ingekwaga na mavumba mkwanja manoti ni kuonge vya thamani ama niwe fundi kuigiza kakanumba masanja joti usiwe mbali nami my darling, I need you now, oh, uwe na mi haki ya Mungu na kupenda. Nobody can show you love, oh, usiwamini ukisha wapa wanakwenda. O basi jilegeze ni kubebe mbongoni dika ni kudekeze nikutunze kama mboni. Wakija wapoteze ifanye kama uwaoni. Kisha uniongeze ulivofunzwa unyagoni. Oh baby, asa dansi ni kone wabamijo ululu femi.
mijo wangwaru basi cheza na mimi wangwaru avan moyo wangwaru paini mchungu kiuziwa same mara sabini uo mzungu sajalewa kependa junga machini kwenye ufungu pareniwa kumbate baridini kwenye tundo kama njua Moyo wangu mio makoti usini jena kibiriti
Asawe
Benzi likage ukachuki nyumba ikawa kibiti
Asawe
Nipatie vya kitandani nipepaka kwenye kiti
Asawe
Ile sininge shetani nawe kaja kukuchiti Koba sijilegezi nikubebe mgongoni
Kielewe
Kitandani nikolezi kwa miuno ya kingoni
Kielewe
Kisho nibembeleze Nirudisha utotoni
Kielewe
Weka mate niteleze Kama nyoka pangoni
Kielewe
Oh baby Asete sikitoko
Wangwalu
Oh wapanwe cho
Wangwalu
Ululu feni
Wangwalu
Oh baby Asacheza nipone
Wangwalu
Uwapa mijo
Wangwalu
Basi cheza na mi
Wangwalu
Ama Nataka kucheza chura na ingali umesimama
Ainama, ainama
Asa onyeshe
Ainama, ainama
Unacheza
Ainama, ainama
Unataka maji ya kisima na mwoga kututamba
Ainama, ainama
Embu onyeshe
Ainama, ainama
Unachotaja
Ainama, ainama
Unataka kupiga deki Wima umesimama
Ainama, ainama
Embu tuonyeshe
Ainama, ainama
Unapiga ye
Ainama, ainama
Si unataka vya puru Bosa mbona unajibana
Ainama, ainama
Ebu tunyeshe
Ainama, ainama
Unalenga ye
Ainama, ainama
Oya wanangu wa kigogo
Ainama
Nipeza moze yobo
Ainama
Funja funja kidogo
Ainama
Anyongeze mikamu
Ainama, ainama
It's Views. See, I just came back from Ghana.
Really?
And I want to share this dance that everyone was doing over there.
What's the
QB tried to show me how to do it. He sat me down in this place.
And what did he say?
And he said to me, Views. Nobody want to see you rising. And when they do, they don't even like it. They just want to see you deep in crisis. Drive yourself, you don't need a license. Holler her, she can even ride it. Go ahead, move your feet just like this. Then he showed me the latest. We walk over them haters. But what you do, man, you're Zonto. Zonto. Azonto, now watch me do my Azonto, 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 now watch me do my Azonto, 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 now watch me do my Azonto, Azonto, we walk over the pages, now watch you do my Azonto, 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 we walk over the pages, now watch you do my to do this, so I'ma take you right through this. Azonto dance is the movement, so when you jump on the floor, better use it. First step is a step, step. You can move to the right, to the left, left. You can even freestyle when you step, step. Put your hands in the air, then you rep, rep. So go, 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 twist your fingers. You can wave and say hello, low, low. Make a fist, then you can hit them with that blow, blow, blow. No balance, that's how you do Azonto, Azonto. Let me see you go. Nobody wanna see you rising. And when they do, they don't even like it. They just wanna see you deep in crisis. Drive yourself, you don't need a license. Holler her, she can even ride it. Go ahead, move your feet just like this. Then he showed me the latest. We walk over them haters. Now what you do, man, you're Azonto, Azonto, Azonto. Now watch me do my Azonto, Azonto, Azonto. Now watch me do my Azonto, Azonto, Azonto. Now watch me do my Azonto, Azonto. We walk over the haters. Now what you do?
Sorisa Azonto, we dien ye yo yo. Enti men ye go slow, mia wenina to blow. Move to the rhythm, here we go. I'll show you how to do this. So, so men sa, men kasa. Up across on the south side. Move to the left and right and watch me free. Azonto, all my ladies strike a pose and free. Trafoto, drop it low and make the boys say damn. Akosombo, freestyle it the way you want to say. Uchimo.
Show me.
Azonto. Oh, Ajay, Ajay, Zingo.
Azonto. Check this out, yo. Head, shoulders, knees, and toes. Free.
Azonto. Oh, yeah. Shashi, wo, wo, shashi, wo, wo. Free.
Azonto. Yeah. Migrants gang, man, I like your show.
Pentisilam dundo.
tuka pop champagne, tuka tanuwe. Bidake deka gekifone, tuka tanuwe.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, it is not necessary to blow out the other person's light to let yours shine. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is committed to maintaining its long-standing position as a global leader on humanitarian issues. We understand the importance and necessity of humanitarian assistance, even as we work to preclude the crises that spawn the need for assistance, said Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan. By helping those who bear the brunt of war, natural disaster, or the failure of good governance and policy, we preserve that chance for a more prosperous and more peaceful world for generations to come. The United States is the single largest donor of international humanitarian assistance. In 2017 alone, we delivered more than $8 billion in life-saving aid around the world. Nonetheless, the need for humanitarian aid is ever-increasing and changing. Just a decade ago, 80% of our humanitarian assistance went to victims of natural disaster. Now, natural disaster relief accounts for only about 20%. 80% of aid goes to victims of disasters caused by humans. Much of that is due to carnage inflicted on civilian populations by terrorist groups such as ISIL and Al-Qaeda, or due to vicious conflicts such as those in Libya, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. What's clear is that one government or one entity can't tackle these issues alone. As we continue this humanitarian leadership, we will also continue to emphasize the importance of coordinated, effective, and efficient international responses, as well as the need for other governments and other actors in the private sector to step in to contribute to humanitarian efforts, said Deputy Secretary of State Sullivan. A global response with increasing financial support of multiple nations and groups is essential to effectively moving more help to the many who are in need and to ensure a greater regional stability across the globe, he declared. Nonetheless, despite our best efforts, most of these crises, conflicts, and natural disasters are not going to stop anytime soon. Most will ultimately require a diplomatic solution, results that we are working toward each and every day. But, said Deputy Secretary of State Sullivan, until those solutions arrive, you can count on the United States to help everyone where we can to alleviate suffering and save lives.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.